We'll hear argument first this morning in Case 15-1293, Lee versus Tam. Mr. Stewart?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The statutory provision at issue in this case, 15 U.S.C. 1052A, prohibits the registration of any mark that may disparage persons, institutions, beliefs, or national symbols. Based on that provision, the PTO denied respondents' application to register the Slants as a service mark for his band. The PTO's ruling did not limit respondents' ability to use the mark in commerce or otherwise to engage in expression or debate on any subject he wishes. Because Section 52A's disparagement provision places a reasonable limit on access to a government program rather than a restriction on speech, it does not violate the First Amendment.
Is copyright a copyright a government program?
I think we would say copyright and copyright registration is a government program, but it's historically been much more tied to First Amendment values, to the incentivization of free expression.
In part, that seems to me to ignore the fact that we have a culture in which we have T-shirts and logos and rock bands and so forth that are expressing a point of view. They're using the market to express views.
I mean, certainly,
the disparagement clearly wouldn't work with copyright, but that's a powerful, important government program.
Let me say two or three things about that. First, there's no question that through their music, the Slants are expressing views on social and political issues. They have a First Amendment right to do that. They're able to copyright their songs and get intellectual property protection that way. If Congress attempted to prohibit them either from having copyright protection or copyright registration on their music, that would pose a much more substantial First Amendment issue.
But substantial First Amendment issue, I was somewhat surprised that in your brief you couldn't bring yourself to say that the government could not deny copyright protection to objectionable material. Are you willing to say that?
I hate to give away any hypothetical statute without hearing the justification, but I'll come as close as I possibly can to saying, yes, we would give that away. It would be unconstitutional to deny copyright protection on that ground. But I would also say, even in the copyright context, we would distinguish between limits on copyright protection and restrictions on speech. For instance, it's historically been the case, and it remains the position of the Copyright Office, that a person can't copyright new words or short phrases. Even if a person comes up with something that is original, that is pithy, that makes a point, if it's too short, you can't get copyright protection. We would certainly defend the constitutionality of that traditional limit on the scope of copyrightable material. And if there were a First Amendment challenge brought, we would argue that there's a fundamental distinction between saying you can't copyright a four-word phrase and saying you can't say the four-word phrase or you can't write it in print.
There's a significant difference between the copyright regime. You can't sue for copyright infringement unless you register. Isn't that so?
You have to have filed an application to register in order to pursue an infringement suit. And so the statute, I believe it's 17 U.S.C. 411A, indicates that if you filed an application to register your copyright, even if that application has been denied, you can still bring your copyright suit, and the register is entitled to be heard on questions of copyrightability.
There's no comparable restriction on the trademark.
That's correct. You can file a suit under Section 1125A of Title 15 under the trademark laws, either for infringement of an unregistered trademark or for unfair competition more generally.
I'm concerned that your government program argument is circular. The claim is you're not registering my mark because it's disparaging, and your answer is, well, we run a program that doesn't include disparaging trademarks. So that's why you're excluded. It doesn't seem to me to advance the argument very much.
Well, I think the disparagement provision is only one of a number of restrictions on trademark registrability that really couldn't be placed on speech itself. For example, words, marks that are merely descriptive, that are generic, marks as to which the applicant is not the true owner because somebody else was previously using the mark in commerce, those can't be registered either.
Each of those, and now I know there are several, are related to the ultimate purpose of a trademark, which is to identify the source of the product. So every trademark makes that statement. Now, what purpose or objective of trademark protection does this particular disparagement provision help along or further? And I'm thinking of the provision that says you can say something nice about a minority group, but you can't say something bad about them. With all the others, I know the others. I don't know all, but I know many of them. And I can relate that. You relate this.
I think Congress evidently concluded that disparaging trademarks would hinder commercial development in the following way. A trademark in and of itself is simply a source identifier. Its function is to tell the public from whom do the goods or services emanate. It is not expressive in its own right. Now, it is certainly true that many commercial actors will attempt to devise trademarks that not only identify them as the source, but that also are intended to convey positive messages about their products. For example, if you see the name Jiffy Lube or a B&B that's called Piney Vista, the mark is sort of a dual-purpose communication. It both identifies the source and it serves as a kind of miniature advertisement. There is always the danger, as some of the amicus briefs on our side point out, that when a person uses as his mark words that have other meanings in common discourse, that it will distract the consumer from the intended purpose of the trademark qua trademark, which is to identify source. And basically, Congress says, as long as you are promoting your own product, saying nice things about people, we'll put up with that level of distraction.
So suppose the application here had been for slants are superior. So that's a complimentary term. Would that then take it outside the disparagement bar?
I think that under the PTO's historical practice, probably not. I believe, and I think the same thing would be true of other racial epithets, terms that have long been used as slurs for particular minority groups.
Why isn't that disparaging of everyone else? Slants are superior. Well, superior to whom?
I think the basis for the PTO's practice, and we obviously don't have that case, is that the term slants in and of itself, when used in relation to Asian Americans.
I have it right. I want to get the answer to my question, because that is the one question I have for you. The only question I have for you is what purpose related to trademark's objective does this serve? And I want to be sure I have your answer. Your answer so far was it prevents it helps to prevent the user of the product from being distracted from the basic message, which is, I made this product. I take it that's your answer. And if that's your answer, my follow-up question to that would be, I can think probably, and with my law clerks perhaps, 50,000 examples of instances where the space that trademark provides is used for very distracting messages, probably as much or more so than the one at issue, or disparagement. And what business does Congress have picking out this one, but letting all the other distractions exist?
Well, I think what you've described as my first-line answer, and I think the precise justification for different kinds of — for prohibiting registration of different kinds of disparaging trademarks would depend to some extent on who is being disparaged. That is, in the
— Disparaging. Your answer was distracting.
And
one of the great things of 99% of all trademarks is they don't just identify. Boy, do they distract. It's a form of advertising. So if the answer is distracting, not — you didn't provide an answer to disparagement. Your answer to why disparagement was they don't want distraction from the message.
They don't want — they don't want distraction, and they don't want particular types of distraction. That is, when we're
That's where I have the question. What relation is there to the particular type of distraction, disparagement, and any purpose of a trademark?
The type of distraction that may be caused by a disparaging trademark will depend significantly on the precise type of disparagement at issue. That is, in the case of racial epithets, these words are known to cause harm, to cause controversy. They, in some sense, they may be no more distracting than a positive message, but Congress can determine this is the wrong kind of distraction.
Mr. Stewart, please.
Another type would be a competing soft drink manufacturer who wants to register the trademark Coke Stinks, who wants to identify his own product with a sentiment that is antithetical to one of his competitors. Congress can determine we would prefer not to encourage that form of commerce. We can prefer to that commercial actors will promote their own products rather than disparage others. Obviously, under the First Amendment, we couldn't prevent that kind of criticism, but we can decline to encourage it. I'm sorry.
Assuming government speech itself is not involved, I always thought that government programs were subject to one extremely important constraint, which is that they can't make distinctions based on viewpoint. So why isn't this doing exactly that?
Because it precludes disparagement of all — I mean, it casts a wide net.
That's absolutely true. It precludes disparagement of Democrats and Republicans alike and so forth and so on. But it makes a very important distinction, which is that you can say good things about some person or group, but you can't say bad things about some person or group. So, for example, let's say that I wanted a mark that expressed the idea that all politicians are corrupt, or just that Democrats are corrupt. Either way, it doesn't matter. I couldn't get that mark, even though I could get a mark saying that all politicians are virtuous, or that all Democrats are virtuous. Either way, doesn't matter. You see the point. The point is that I can say good things about something, but I can't say bad things about something. And I would have thought that that was a fairly classic case of viewpoint discrimination.
Well, as we pointed out in our brief, laws like libel laws have not historically been treated as discriminating based on viewpoint, even though they
seem — Well, that's libel is in one of our historically different but very distinct categories. And you don't make the claim that this falls into a category of low-value speech in the way that libel laws, in the way that defamation does, or fighting words or something like that. And you're not looking to create a new category. So in that case, it seems that the viewpoint-based ban applies. And this, as I said, I would be interested to hear your answer of why the example that I stated is not viewpoint based. It says you can say something bad about, you can say something good about somebody, but not something bad about somebody or something.
Well, certainly if you singled out a particular category of people, like political officials, and said you can't say anything bad about any of them, but you can say all the good things you want, I think that would be viewpoint based because it would be protected a discrete group of people. Let me just give a couple of other answers.
But
if you didn't limit it, if you said you can't say anything bad about anybody anytime,
again,
then that's okay?
Again, we're not saying you can't say anything bad. We're saying we don't register your trademark if it is disparaging. Certainly.
No. I said even in a government program, even assuming that this is not just a classic speech restriction, you're still subject to the constraint that you can't discriminate on the basis of viewpoint.
Well, in Boos versus Berry, it's not a majority opinion, but the court there was confronted with a law that made it illegal to, I believe it was, post signs or engage in expressive activity within 500 feet of a foreign embassy that was intended to bring the foreign government into contempt or disrepute. And the law was struck down as sweeping too broadly, but at least the plurality would have held that it was not viewpoint-based because it applied to all foreign embassies. It didn't turn on the nature of the criticism. Another example I would give, and it's a hypothetical example, but at least I have a strong instinct as to how the case should be decided. Suppose at a public university, the school set aside a particular room where students could post messages on topics that were of interest or concern to them as a way of promoting debate in a non-confrontational way. And the school said just two ground rules: no racial epithets and no personal attacks on any other members of the school community. It would seem extraordinary to say that's a viewpoint-based distinction that can't stand because you're allowed to say complimentary things about your fellow students.
So the government is the omnipresent school teacher? I mean, is that what you're saying?
No.
The government's a school teacher?
No. Again, That analysis would apply only if the public school was setting aside a room in its own facility. Clearly, if the government attempted more broadly to restrict disparaging speech by students or others, rather than simply to limit the terms under which a forum for communication could be made available, that would involve entirely different questions. That's why the plurality in Booth versus Berry would have found the law unconstitutional, even though they found it not to be viewpoint-based.
One distinction is the scope of the government program. If you're talking about a particular discussion venue at a public university, that's one thing. If you're talking about the entire trademark program, it seems to me to be something else.
Well, the trademark registration program and trademarks generally have not historically served as vehicles for expression. That is, the Lanham Act defines trademark and service mark purely by reference to their source identification functions. And I think it's to get back to copyright for just a second, I think it's at least noteworthy that everyone would recognize that Mr. Tam is not entitled to a copyright on the slants. The Copyright Office doesn't register short phrases. Two words is certainly short, especially
not
when one of them is.
Not because of the content or the viewpoint expressed. It's just it's a short phrase, and any short phrase would be no good. This is you can't say slants because the PTO thinks that's a bad word. Does it not count at all that everyone knows that the slants is using this term not at all to disparage, but simply to describe?
I think
to take the sting out of the word.
Well, if the trademark examining attorney went through this in a lot of detail, and the trademark examiner acknowledged that Mr. Tam's sincere intent appeared to be to reclaim the word, to use it as a symbol of Asian American pride rather than to use it as a slur. He also found a lot of evidence in the form of internet commentary to the effect that many Asian Americans, even those who recognized that this was Mr. Tam's intent, still found the use of the word as a band name offensive. The point I was trying to make about copyright is not that copyright protection would be denied on the ground of disparagement. You're right, it would be denied because it's a short phrase and not even an original phrase. But copyright is kind of the branch of intellectual property law that is specifically intended to foster free expression on matters of cultural and political, among other significance.
And do you deny that trademarks are used for expressive purposes?
I don't deny that trademarks are used for expressive purposes. As I was saying earlier, I think many commercial actors will pick a mark that will not only serve as a source identifier, but that will cast their products in an attractive light and or that will communicate a message on some other topic. My only point is, in deciding whether a particular trademark should be registered, Congress is entitled to focus exclusively on the source identification aspect.
I wonder if you are not stretching the concept of a government program past the breaking point. The government provides lots of services to the general public, and I don't think you would say that those fall within the government program line of cases that you're talking about, like providing police protection to the general public or providing fire protection to the general public. Those cost money, and those are government programs. Can the government say, well, we're going to provide protection for some groups but not for other groups?
No, I think those would raise serious — I mean, depending on the nature of the distinction, equal protection problems, potential
Potential First Amendment problems, too, if the nature of the distinction was based on the person's speech. Isn't that right?
Well, certainly. I mean, clearly if it was based on viewpoint, and clearly I would say
— absolutely clearly if it was based on viewpoint. And so I guess I don't want to interrupt your answer to Justice Alito if — but I want to get back to — because I don't really understand the answer that you gave me before. You said a government regulation that distinguished between saying politicians are good and virtuous and politicians are corrupt would clearly be viewpoint-based. Is that right?
Right.
So, and similarly, if you said that the flag is a wonderful emblem — this applies to national symbols — but you could say that the flag is a wonderful emblem, but you can't say that the flag is a terrible emblem. That would be viewpoint-based.
Well,
I mean, that's what this regulation does.
It says
you can say one of those things, but you can't say the other and get trademark.
But it sweeps with a broad brush. And I think the reason that viewpoint-based discrimination has historically been the most disfavored type of regulation from a First Amendment perspective is that it creates the danger that the government is attempting to suppress disfavored messages. I mean, there's a TTAB, a Trademark Trial and Appeal Board decision from 1969 that declined to register a proposed trademark that was essentially the Soviet hammer and sickle with a slash through it. And registration was denied on the ground that it disparaged the national symbol of the Soviet Union. Now, obviously, hostility towards the Soviet Union was not inconsistent with United States policy in 1969. No one would have perceived the denial of trademark registration as an attempt to suppress a disfavored viewpoint. And the point of the point of my defense of the statute is it sweeps with such a broad brush.
But that's like saying it does so much viewpoint-based discrimination that it becomes all right.
But it does so. I mean, it imposes this restriction only within the confines of a government program. And
Yes, and I'm willing to give you that. But even government programs, again, assuming it's not government speech itself, even government programs are subject to this constraint, which is that you can't distinguish based on the viewpoint of a speaker.
Well, part of this government program is government speech. And let me just describe the two types of basic services that the PTO performs in the course of administering the program. First, when an application is filed, the examining attorney and potentially the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board will go through it to see whether the applicant satisfies the statutory prerequisites to registration. And some of those, like 1052A, are not essential to having a valid trademark. But many of the prerequisites to registration overlap with the prerequisites to having a valid trademark. And so when the examining attorney decides, is this merely descriptive? Is it generic? Does it serve as a mark that consumers will associate with the product in commerce? Is this person the true owner of the mark? The examining attorney is deciding the same sorts of questions that could arise in an infringement suit if the applicant ever filed one. And therefore,
what about scandalous? That's another one. Scandalous or immoral. Those are just like disparage. They block you from registering the mark, right?
They do block you from registering the mark, not from filing an infringement suit or alleging unfair competition.
But that's the same thing.
That's the same thing as disparagement. I was just saying many of the other statutory prerequisites do overlap with the prerequisites to having a valid trademark. And so if the examining attorney approves the application, he is giving the applicant at least some comfort that he can continue to use the mark in commerce with a degree of confidence that if somebody else infringes the mark, he will be able to satisfy the prerequisites.
Running the federal courts is a government program. Can you say that the courts, when it comes to trademarks, the courts are not open for actions to enforce infringement of a disparaging trademark?
I mean, if Congress had taken to its furthest possible step the desire to disassociate the federal government from the enforcement of from these marks.
Yeah, that was how the hypothetical was framed.
Right.
The furthest possible step, but it's the same. Do you apply the same analysis you do simply with the, as in this case, how far can they go in defining the government program?
I think we would typically think of the PTO's exercise of discretionary authority and as the exercise of discretionary authority by an executive branch agency as different from the neutral enforcement of the law by the courts. Obviously,
if it's a government program, can you do anything you want with speech? Or what are the restrictions that we can? Is it intermediate? You don't argue that this statute meets strict scrutiny.
I think the basic test would be, is it reasonably related to the objectives of the government program? And in cases of viewpoint discrimination, in cases where the program raises the concern that the government is attempting to promote disfavored messages and suppress disfavored messages, the program would be presumptively unconstitutional. The second form of service that the PTO provides in the course of administering the program is that if it decides the trademark should be registered, it publishes the trademark on the Federal Register. And publication has is significant in a variety of ways. First, outside the context of legal suits, publication of the trademark on the Federal Register reduces the likelihood that any infringement will occur because it provides notice to potential competitors in commerce that the PTO has approved this mark. It will give them an incentive to choose marks that are not confusingly similar.
Because your time is running, the questions have concentrated on viewpoint discrimination, but there's also a large concern with vagueness here, and the list that we have of things that were trademarked and things that weren't. Take, for example, one had the word Hebe, and that was okay in one application, and it was not okay in another.
I guess, first, if the Court accepts our basic theory that this should be judged by the standards that typically apply to government benefits under a government program, although the statute doesn't draw an entirely bright line, it's sufficiently clear. The Court has approved, for instance, the criteria for awarding NEA grants that were at issue in Finley to the effect that the grant givers should take account of the diverse views and beliefs of the American public. The PTO receives 300,000 trademark applications every year, so it's not surprising that there is some potential inconsistency. And the other thing I would — the other two things I would say are, first
— Isn't it another way to say it's not clear enough for them to get it right?
It's not a bright-line rule. I would say two further things before I sit down. The first is that I think a lot of the examples that the PTO has had trouble with and where it may there may be an appearance and perhaps the fact of inconsistent decisions are instances where people are deliberately using terms that have historically been insulting, but with the intent to be edgy, provocative, to reclaim the slur. This is entirely legitimate, but when people self-consciously use words in a way other than they have traditionally been used, it's not surprising that sometimes they're misunderstood. The second thing I'd say is the examples that the other side gives raise the concern that the PTO might have approved some trademarks that it shouldn't have approved, but they really haven't identified any examples of marks that were rejected as disparaging, even though no reasonable person could view them as such. If I may, I'd like to preserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, counsel.